Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone in Atlanta. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I am thrilled at our guest this afternoon. I met her actually about 2 or 3 months ago out in the community, and we actually shared something in common. My niece had come to visit me and whipped out her computer and her special little glasses with her eye-tracking exercises, and I asked her, what in the heck is that? And she started talking to me about her vision therapy. Right. And then a couple of months later, I met Dr. Takiya Locke. So welcome for today. Dr. Takiya Locke. And let me tell you a little bit about her. She's one of those rare people that knew early in her life what she wanted to do. At about age 16, she knew she was going to dedicate her professional career to the vision specialty, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And her father's a physician. She's kind of raised in medical. And also she went to Howard University, got her Bachelor of Science in Health Management, and then went on to get her Doctor of Optometry at Nova Southeast University, correct?
Correct, yep.
Very good. And she's well-published in the area. She has some special interests in autism, dry eye disease, glaucoma. Pediatric vision therapy is going to be our primary topic for today. And she's also an infancy provider. And for those of you that don't know what that is, we'll fill you in on that in a little bit.
Sounds good.
So welcome for today. We really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, too.
Yeah. So one of the things that in doing the research I found that was pretty interesting, being a nurse, I know some of the backgrounds, but we think of vision testing or eye care as going to get our 20/20 check, right?
You got it, yeah.
And it starts, we think, sometimes in school, and when we can't see, maybe later in our life as our vision changes, but a lot more goes into it than just that little vision test.
Yes, a lot more.
A lot more. I was also surprised to know that, not really surprised, but just gently reminded that sometimes when kids can't see early on, they think that's normal, and so they don't report, we don't have problems, and a lot of times we could nip things in the bud a little earlier, but right. We find and uncover some of these things once the kids kind of start in the school age.
Right. Well, you have to remember, children don't know what normal is. They don't have a reference point. So they can't tell you that things are changing or things are different. And sometimes at school, they get that reference point and they realize their friend sees something they don't see or something's hard that they don't feel like should be hard. And that might be the first clue. But usually there's clues we can find long before right. that.
And I also found out it's way more common than I thought. I found a statistic, I think from the CDC, saying something like 1 in 10 children are at risk for undetected vision, which to me sounded really high.
Absolutely. Well, there's 1 in 5 that usually might have a reading problem. And the vision portion of that a lot of times goes undetected. So finding a real true statistic is hard because we miss a lot of these children if they're not coming to a specialist in particular, because sometimes you have to ask the right questions and do the right testing in order to identify it.
Right. So I know we talked about things being missed. So let's jump right into kind of where the beginning is. So I was surprised, we were talking in the green room just a minute ago about, in the research, I was surprised that the recommendation for the first eye exam is actually at 6 months of age.
Absolutely. The AOA recommends 6 months to 12 months. The first eye exam should occur, and it should be a comprehensive eye exam. So this is different than what you get at the pediatrician's office. And anybody that is an infancy provider, that exam is actually free. It doesn't cost anything. And we're basically just screening for red flags. So we're screening for things that may take away your vision later, may cause you to develop a lazy eye later in life. So it's more of an in-depth look at both potentially vision-threatening or even life-threatening conditions that could start in the eye, and then also the possibility of needing some type of correction or some type of treatment later on.
So just being curious, since a six-month can't really talk to you verbally, how do you do that?
I get that question all the time. So the technical term for how we check their vision is called forced preferential looking. And believe it or not, children are very, very, very visual. So you find something that they want to look at. If they cannot see it, they don't look at it. So the tests are actually a lot of fun. You play a lot of games, and you can do an entire eye exam without any verbal feedback whatsoever. A lot of what we do is using lights looking at reflexes, seeing how accurate a child can grab. And of course, we have to know where they are in their development, whether it's a 6-month-old versus a 10-month-old. Their development is really different. So you have to kind of have a little bit of a background of what to expect. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you kind of gear the testing towards that. But they do not have to say a word. We don't need any feedback. Most of it is lights, toys, games, and of course, the preferential looking.
And I'm sure that most of the exams turn out normal, but of the ones that you do find, what do you find?
Most of the 6 months to 12 months do turn out normal, with the exception of eye turns, or the huge finding that we get is that there might be one eye that will have a prescription difference compared to the other. And depending on how different that is, that child is likely to develop lazy eye if you don't intervene. That one is actually pretty common. One thing that I think is really funny to work with moms, because most kids do look like they have a little bit of an eye turn in, and there's medical terms for all of that. But we find that a lot. Mom is concerned that the eyes are turning in, and it's not actually the case at all. So sometimes it's just assuring mom that this is actually normal.
Yeah, so you treat the mom, not the kid.
Exactly.
In that particular
sometimes.
Time. I also read that, you know, although that's the recommendation, only 13%
yes.
of moms actually
know about it.
Know about that. So how can we, besides the radio show here, how can we get the word out? Or
I think I've talked to moms, and usually moms are the best marketing tool. They have friends that are moms. They're part of mom groups. They go to daycare. So really, I think word of mouth is huge, because the big question is, you know, how do you do that? How are you going to test an infant so they don't even think it's possible?
Right.
So once a mom sees what we do, you know, they're great advocates for the program, and they don't pay a thing.
Right. Now, so talking about infancies, this was a word that came up. You were an infancy provider.
Yes.
I wasn't even really aware of this program.
Right.
Can you explain a little bit about what that is? And
the program is basically, it's funded by the AOA, I believe, and we do have to send the results back, but all it is really a step-by-step screening tool. And the goal of it is to get in the children early enough so that if they are going to have a problem later, we basically can come up with a plan for that child. So sometimes we'll say the next exam is going to be at 3 years old, or sometimes, oh no, this child needs to come back in another 6 months. So it's basically a plan to monitor the visual development
like
of that child.
It's like
exactly.
following like a track.
Exactly.
For the child.
Okay. And then we submit the information to the AOA so that they can better track what we're finding in these kids.
Okay, very good.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back then. We kind of talked a little bit about the 6-month-old visit, but I think most people, their entry point is in the pediatrician's office.
Absolutely.
So how is that what I would think of as, I've just bought my mom in the annual checkup we all go for. We feel like we live there, but we do the annual one.
Right.
And we think, my orientation is the eye chart.
Right.
So I know that there's a lot more to that in a comprehensive eye exam. Why don't you
right.
educate us about the difference?
Well, the eye chart at most pediatricians' office, I don't want to say all, because some of them do have more screening tools than the eye chart.
Right.
But usually it's done at a distance. And usually you have to pay attention to the child that's doing the exam as well, because children have a lot of coping mechanisms. If one eye, for example, I see it all the time, one eye might be hidden behind their hand or something like that, but they'll peek when it gets hard. So there's certain little coping mechanisms that you have to watch in children. But then the fact that it's done at a distance, a lot of children, especially farsighted children, can see perfectly fine at a distance. And you have to remember that their world is not in the distance. Their world is up close. They're learning up close mostly in school. Now with iPads and iPhones and video games, I mean, very much it's the case now that their children's world is pretty much arm length and closer. So testing a child at the distance, you're going to miss things.
So how do you test them for their sight in the near space?
You can do similar things. So you can use a chart if the child's old enough to tell you what they can see. But again, a lot of using lights and reflexes, we want to test for eye turns that might not be manifest or focusing problems. So there's a lot of different diagnostic testing that pediatric optometrists will do that's very different than just reading an eye chart. Sometimes reading an eye chart doesn't matter at all.
Right, because there's other
Problems.
Yeah.
Even if they can see the eye chart perfectly, it doesn't mean that there's not another problem in the connection between what they're getting from the eye chart and how it's connecting to their brain, and therefore the output. So the output is going to be reading comprehension and grades and even sports. Mm-hmm. So how that connection is going from their vision to their motor or their vision to their hearing, depending on what it is that they're learning. Mm-hmm. The connections are huge, and those are the kinds of things that we look for in an exam.
Okay, so what is like a recommended standard? If we have the first exam at 6 months, then if it's it's normal, what would be?
Usually 3 years. So okay. If it's normal, usually you'll come back around 3 years of age and then before they start any type of school. I tell my moms it's really dependent on what that child is going to be doing. If it's an advanced child that's going to be reading music at age three, that's not uncommon these days. I mean, I get children that are learning different languages at age.
I can't even keep up with the kids' schedule these days.
It's amazing what you hear these days.
So I used to play.
In our practice, everything is pretty much family, you know, dependent. So a general recommendation would be 6 to 12 months for the first exam, age three for the next, and then before they start school, which is usually 5 or 6 for the one after that. And if there's any red flags at all, we'd follow them a lot more closely than that.
Okay. And then certainly if you find something, it's dependent upon what you find, what you would recommend the treatment to be after that. Okay. So let's go on into the general idea of pediatric vision therapy. Mm-hmm. Let's just say you tested that kid, their mm-hmm. school age. How would someone find you? Like, how is it a reading problem? Is it the kids squint in school? You know, what are some common paths to a referral back to you?
The common symptoms usually overlap with any other type of symptoms, such as ADHD symptoms. A lot of the symptoms are really coping mechanisms that the child has developed. So, for example, if your child covers one eye when they're reading or gets really close to what they're reading, a lot of times when they're getting really close, they're able to shut off information from one eye, which makes it easier for them, not having to get in the information from two eyes. So a lot of it is coping mechanisms, and you just kind of have to watch your child. Squinting is an obvious one, and usually mm-hmm. that one's pretty easy to treat. Mm-hmm. Things like excessive blinking, falling asleep, and avoiding reading is huge. A lot of what we talk about in our practice is your child reaching the potential that you think they have? Because most of these children are smart, and they have to read in order to learn what the school's wanting them to learn, and they avoid it. It doesn't mean they don't want to. Most kids want to learn. They want to know what's put in front of them. They want to know more than what's put in front of them. So a lot of it is just that conversation. Is your child, you know, avoiding reading but loves to be read to? Those are the kinds of things that we usually talk about.
That's a good clue. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we just push them. A lot of times we're just like, what do you mean?
What's wrong with you?
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
We don't think it's a vision problem.
Exactly, yeah, but one good example, and it's usually easier to do examples in person, but the eyes are never looking in the same place at the same time. One eye sees one thing, another eye sees another. A big piece of the puzzle is fusing those two images. So if you can imagine a child's reading and one eye is looking at one word and another eye is looking at another word, how are they ever going to, you know, fuse the image and make sense of what's coming next? So there's a lot of skills that are involved with reading. And of course, it starts with the eyes, but if the child is not fusing, or if they can't find their place or follow along a page or read to the end of one line and then find the next line, of course, the comprehension is going to go down, and it's very difficult for them. So they stop. Mm-hmm. They avoid it.
Mm-hmm. So is it usually the moms that bring them, the teachers that send them, the pediatricians that send them?
Both. I get referrals from everywhere. Moms, of course, are probably number one, but there's some teachers that are very in tune with children, and they're a great source of referrals. And then, of course, pediatricians. We've got a couple of pediatricians that we work with that send over a lot of children. And unfortunately, most of the pediatrician referrals are usually having to do with the eye chart. But there are some pediatricians that I think are starting to learn that there's more than just, you know, the eye chart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
there's just a lot of them.
There's a lot of education, I think,
exactly.
With new information.
New information and what's available, exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk just very broadly about pediatric vision therapy, mm-hmm. what that is, and then we'll kind of go through some of the common ailments that you see and kind of what the causes and the treatments and the pathways are to make them better. So.
Okay. Vision therapy is probably similar to physical therapy in a sense. There's different ways that you do therapy. So a lot of people think of prescribing lenses to see 20/20, but you can also prescribe lenses that are more therapeutic, not so much to treat, whether you're nearsighted or farsighted, but to more improve the function or the efficiency of your eyes. So some of therapy is prescribing lenses or prisms or filters, colored filters. And then beyond that, there might be exercises involved to strengthen usually one eye at a time and then both eyes together. And a lot of it is going to be dependent on what that problem is. There's also a more abstract area, visual perception. And that's huge in terms of learning to read and reading comprehension, ease of reading and speed of reading. A lot of the visual perceptual problems are difficult to diagnose. So that's difficult to find in a pediatrician's office, even more difficult to find in a school setting. So those are things that we work on as well. And these are things like laterality, directionality, form recognition, figure ground. These are a little bit more complex and abstract, but those are also things that we'd work on because we know in the big picture of reading, those skills are important as well.
Are those more related to learning disabilities, or are they more related to actual clinical problems?
Both. So there are certain learning disabilities that you're more likely to have certain perceptual difficulties. For example, knowing right from left is a common one. But obviously knowing your right from left and knowing your right from left and then being able to project it. So I need to know what's your right and what's your left looking at you. Those are all kind of spatial issues that children might have. And sometimes if you have a learning disability, it's definitely more likely that you might have that kind of a problem. But if you want to distinguish between a B and a D, we might take for granted the fact that we need to know which one is pointing right and which one is pointing left. Yeah. But some children, it's very hard to know that. So we'll train different ways, usually relating it on their body first and then somebody else's body next and eventually on an object and kind of building those skills up from there, depending on, you know, where it fell apart in their system.
You know, the reason it's of interest with me was my son had a learning disability, and never once, he's now graduated, but never once did anyone ever bring up his vision. Mm-hmm. And recently, he's 20, he had a vision test and failed it. Mm. And the therapist came back and said, it's not too late. Get him back in,
exactly.
And it'll help him still, exactly. Even as an adult. So
I'm a poster child for that. I have an underlying binocular vision problem as well, and I didn't find out until optometry school. So like I said, there's coping mechanisms. So there's certain sports I avoided because I wouldn't be good at it because my eyes aren't efficient. So there's certain things that you learn to do. You still can become very successful, but when you look back, it's just how much easier could it have been had it been caught?
Well, I think a big thing that just really is ringing true with me is the idea that the kids cope very early.
Very early.
And so they just adapt because they don't
adapt.
Know any different.
They don't.
And if you don't know what you're looking for,
exactly.
you just wonder. Yeah,
exactly.
That's true. Well, let's get into some of the common vision conditions that might be treated kind of by category. So let's start first with binocular vision disorders. You mentioned that yourself.
Okay. So that's pretty much a large umbrella of a disorder. So anybody with a lazy eye or a manifest eye turner or strabismus definitely is going to also have a binocular vision disorder, because all that means is using both eyes together at the same time to get the information in efficiently. So under that category, there could be things like eye turns, whether it's your eye turning in or out, whether it's all the time or some of the time. There can also be eye turns that are not manifest. It's usually more of a posture. So even when you're sitting, somebody might have a tendency to point their toe in or out. Your eyes are very similar. There's a certain posture that's comfortable. And if your posture that's comfortable tends to be in and tense, sometimes reading can get exhausting. So those are things that are not so manifest that would also fall under that umbrella of binocular vision disorders.
So eye turns, do they more commonly involve one eye or both eyes?
I would say it's probably a toss-up. Okay. The manifest ones are usually probably one eye. The one manifest meaning that you can look at somebody and see that they have mm-hmm. one. Usually the underlying ones that you might not see all the time because the child can fuse sometimes are both eyes.
Okay, strabismus. What's tough?
That condition is a huge, I guess, sometimes the strabismus can be because of a prescription or a lazy eye or something like that. But it's also important to know that sometimes these eye turns are for something more serious. There could be a mass in the brain. So the most important thing, especially when there's an eye turn that's new, is to get them checked, to get them dilated, and to make sure that there's not something underlying, for example, a tumor or a malformation in the brain that's causing that eye turn. So that's a huge thing that we always have to rule out first.
A lot of clinical
exactly.
big thing.
Yes.
Red flags.
Exactly. So that's something you have to rule out first. Sometimes the headaches or the way the eye turn, there's certain characteristics of the eye turn that would lead us down that direction. And that's not something that I would treat. That's something that I would prefer to refer.
And are they found or seen at a certain age, or they just go across all ages?
They can be found at any age, again, depending on the underlying trouble. And even if it's, for example, say you were born more likely to have an eye turn than somebody that's not, that can even manifest later at age 2 or 3. So it doesn't mean you're born with that manifest eye turn. And it doesn't mean that because it comes at age 2 or 3 that it's going to be because of a mass. But those are one of those things that we have to rule out first. And then, of course, if it comes later in life and all of a sudden you have an eye turn that you didn't have, those are always going to be clues. Is there some type of trauma or something else going on that caused that eye turn? In adults, it's actually diabetes is a huge one that can actually cause an eye turn. So there's a lot of underlying conditions that you have to rule out first, whether it's a child or an adult, and it can come at any age.
And how, well, you mentioned dilation is one form of test that you
yes.
do. What would be other tests that you do?
To find an eye turn mm-hmm. or?
Or to verify or decide what the treatment would be?
It depends on the age. So one of the things that we look at anytime with an eye turn is the reflex that comes back to us when we're looking in at a light. So that's one of the tests that we would look at in a very young child to see that those reflexes are equal and lined up. Other tests, one is called the cover test. So that's where we can bring out an eye turn that might not be manifest or for break fusion. So we talked a little bit about fusing images with the eye. Mm-hmm. So when we break that fusion, sometimes we can bring out an eye turn as well. Those are probably the most common tests that we would do and probably the quickest.
Okay. And you brought up another point, genetics.
Yes.
How much does genetics play into this?
It does play a role. Definitely I get those families that it's like, wait, but nobody else has a problem.
Yeah.
But the statistics are usually up to about 25% if both parents have some kind of condition or eye turn. It's up to 25% that your child might have it as well.
Okay, so if you had it, be on the lookout.
Be on the lookout. Definitely. Okay. Your child is definitely more likely. But it doesn't mean that I had a family last week, for example, mom, dad, nobody. He wore glasses, but this child has an astronomical prescription in mom's eyes, and they're like, where did it come from? And some of it's environmental. Some of it's environmental and behavioral, and the research is really all over the place just in terms of where it comes from, because I don't think you can pinpoint it to one thing. Just because mom and dad have something doesn't mean that you're going to have it, and you see that in everything with children, you know.
Well, and we're actually getting into a little bit of the conversation of factors. So genetics
right.
is one factor, but another factor you mentioned is environment. Another factor is their activity. So the
right.
computer, they have
behaviors,
more computer chips
exactly.
in their crib than we sent man to the moon with when my generation.
Exactly. And there's research showing that, you know, it's better to get kids outside, and that helps in terms of their development of their vision. But really it is all over the place. There's nutritional information that's out there that'll say, well, you know, if you're lacking this vitamin or lacking certain things in your diet, you're more likely to get a vision problem as well.
Okay, accommodative dysfunction.
Okay. What that means is basically your eyes accommodate or focus anytime you're looking up close. That's a system that's automatic that our wonderful bodies just kick in because they know we need to see something clearly up close. Mm-hmm. Involved in that are muscles. So there are muscles that have to work in order for you to be able to focus on something up close. So a disorder in that is something where those muscles aren't working like they should. So one of the more common ones is the muscle just doesn't feel like working. It's too hard. So that person cannot focus up close. It's very difficult. And therefore, when they're reading, it's going to be blurry or blurry sometimes. So imagine if you're reading along a page and you can see clearly that it's an A in one word, but then in the next word, it doesn't really look like an A. So you don't know what that word is. And where mom gets frustrated is that, wait, but you know A. You know the letter A. You just said the letter A. Well, mom, those muscles aren't working very well. So now muscles are tired and just don't feel like seeing the next A. They've done enough work. It's tired. I can't do anymore. So they shut it off and it gets blurry. So again, that's where the reading problem comes in. Another one would be the infacility. So once you look up close, you have to then look far sometimes if you're copying from the board or playing sports. You have to be able to do both back and forth. So for example, if you're focusing up close and you're working really hard to do that and then you lock in that focus, when you look up, that becomes blurry. A lot of people will right away say, okay, it's a problem far, but that's actually a near problem because you're locking in that focusing system and you can't relax
it. Adjust, right.
You can't adjust now that you have to look far. So that's another pretty common one that we work on.
As you're talking, I'm thinking of how it looks in my camera.
You know, when you move your camera and it focuses on the back, and I'm waiting for it to catch
up. It's a dynamic system.
So it would be like an example of what we would
see. That's exactly right. It has to be able to change depending on what you're looking at.
And so that kind of, I guess, gets into when you're talking about the physical therapy, similar mm-hmm. aspects of mm-hmm. vision therapy, then would you actually prescribe muscle training type exercises?
Yes, so we build those muscles or those focusing skills up. A lot of times we can use lenses to induce the need to focus. So if we use a certain lens, that's going to tell your eye, okay, I need to clear through this lens, and that's kind of building up that ability in the child. And then a lot of it is awareness. So in my vision therapy programs, I work on the child being aware of when their muscles are working and when their eyes are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Because you can teach young children to be aware. They're very, very intelligent. For example,
so if I'm four, what would you tell me? Tanya, what?
Well, I had a five-year-old. Four is a little bit young to work mm-hmm. a whole lot on awareness, but there's probably some things I would do. And again, it depends on the child. But I had one child.
I'm a very smart
four-year-old. Basically, we pay attention to how the eyes feel. So the eyes will feel differently usually when you're doing a lot of work versus when you're not. And then obviously, if you're looking at something and it's not clear, there's a visual clue that you'll get. So a lot of the awareness work is just letting the child know the difference of what their eyes are doing. Because I love children so much and have so much fun with them, a lot of times I'll show them on me. You could see what my eyes are doing now, and then versus when I'm looking far, now what are my eyes doing? Can you make your eyes do the same thing? And then there's lots of different tools. So there's millions of activities that we have. And I could even probably make activities just based on what I can find in this room to make the child understand what their eyes need to do. And they do get it.
Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of screening tool that's out there that parents could use just at home, like a quick screen?
It'd probably be easier to demonstrate than say.
Okay.
Most of the quick screening tools are going to be asking the right questions. So there are symptom questionnaires that we have that are really good. And just, you know, looking at watching your child, just looking at their habits. Do they have a habit of coming real close? Do they have a habit of turning the paper to the side or covering one eye? So a lot of it is just going to be watching your child, but there are a symptom checklist that probably would be helpful, not so much a screening tool that you can send home easily without showing you how it works.
We'll try to get that from you and put it up on the blog.
Sure,
I think
it's
more that people know kind of what to ask.
That's what it is, the right conversation.
New business opportunities. I wanted to kind of go back for a minute to the idea of the accommodation.
Sure.
When you talked about the actual lenses that you mm-hmm. use to make the eyes accommodate better, is that an escalating process? Like they wear one set of glasses for a while,
well,
then it would get better?
These are lenses that we use in therapy. So the glasses that I would normally send home more help in the immediate problem.
Okay.
So, for example, if a child is not able to focus the way they need to, you could send glasses to help with that focusing. Whereas in therapy, when they're actually doing the therapy, we're using lenses to make them work. So it's more like when you go to the gym, you might not really be able to lift 20 pounds your first day, but you're building up to be able to lift that 20 pounds. So in therapy, it's more making them work hard, whereas lenses that I would send home is taking away some of the work that they have to do so they can get through their schoolwork.
Okay. And when you do, just to kind of give the listeners an idea of the length of time or whatever, like what would be an average length of time that you would start an exercise, mm-hmm. eye exercise program, and they'd have to keep
That's a good question. A lot of that is dependent both on the condition and the child. No two children are similar. So there could be one condition that one child has and another condition has the same child has, and it'll take me, say, 20 weeks to fix one and 30 weeks to fix another. The individual sessions are usually about 45 minutes, again, dependent on the child. There's some children that don't want to work with me for 45 minutes. Most of the time, they like to stay longer.
Now, do they come to you for each therapy? Because
yes.
I know my little niece actually did some at home on a computer.
Yes, so it's a combination of both. So usually, the office therapy, we monitor their progress, which is important. And then there's usually home activities that we send home. And because they're learning a new skill, it's very much like learning any other new skill, for example, learning a new instrument. So you want to practice it at least 5 times a week, usually for 20 to 30 minutes is enough. And again, I tailor my programs towards the child and the family. family, because sometimes that's a lot for a family and it might not be the best time to start an intensive training program if they have swim class and baseball and all these other activities, you know, going on as well. So basically the gist of it is I would say a minimum of, you know, 15, 20 weeks. It can go up much longer than that to a year, and you want to be working at home at least 5 times a week for a few minutes, 20 okay. to 30 minutes.
And then would the expectation be that it would be corrected for the yes. rest of your life,
yes.
or is it something that comes
yes.
back and it cycles back around again?
Rarely.
Like it's like you've trained your muscles
yes.
then.
Yes. It rarely comes back. And usually if it comes back, there's something else that triggered it. But once you've trained, especially if you've really worked on the eye awareness piece and teaching a child to be aware of when their eyes are doing what they're supposed to be doing easily, usually it does not come back.
Okay. And then when I'm just trying to imagine my dyslexic ADHD mm-hmm. son sitting in front of the computer for 5 minutes
right.
and he's looking out the window. Can you even do that with learning disabilities?
Yes,
okay.
absolutely.
All right. So you would
but
just...
that's why you work within that child's limits.
Yes. So that would be the
so
tailoring.
So 30 minutes of home therapy might not be possible
still.
For
so
that
So you might
child.
Do more frequently, but less time.
Maybe, or maybe more in-office visits. And
okay.
I usually send a combination of things home that are both fun, because there's fun activities that you can actually use. And again, I have fun with this. This is my passion. So I can turn anything into a therapy activity. You tell me what you like and I'll make it therapy.
Wow.
So that way...
Like what's an example?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of one that I've done recently. But even things like... connect the dots or something like that. We do a bingo game mm-hmm. that a lot of kids have fun with where they have to find a clue with one lens, for example, that might be working their eyes. And then once they find the clue, we have a race to see who finds the answer. So we make games out of it, mm-hmm. you know, whenever we need to. I had another...
I wish I still could learn that way. I'd be much more compliant myself.
The hard thing about it is that you have to remember these are things that are very hard for these children that we might be taking for granted. So if I'm going to force them to use their eyes for 30 minutes at home when they also have to do homework and they also have to do their chores, you want to make it something that they're going to want to do when you can. So I try to make it as fun as possible, but while still remembering that we need to build their system.
So how quickly would, if I'm a parent, I bring a child in, I'm starting down a vision therapy path of, say, this accommodation exercise mm-hmm. program for 20 to 30 weeks, when might the child and I expect to start to see a change?
That's a great question. I would love to put, you know, a firm few weeks on it. I've heard in as few as 5 weeks,
wow.
Children have noticed a difference. But then some children, it'll take longer, you know, and I'm very honest and upfront, you know, there's certain problems and certain children with more than one problem that it might take a lot longer, 10 weeks, 12 weeks before they start to see
periodic retesting?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's huge. Not only that, I send, a list of goals home. So anytime I consult with a parent that I'm going to treat, I let them know I want to treat A, B, C, and D. But on top of that, these are the results I expect. And we monitor those results. And again, mine is very family and child tailored, but periodically, you know, every 5 to 12 weeks, depending on what I'm noticing in therapy, we'll monitor it and we rework actual numbers. Because I do think it's important to see the changes that are being made, even if they're not showing up at home yet.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it gets to a point with most children, and it's so much fun when it happens, where all of a sudden things are clicking and things start working at home and everything with school is getting better. I had one parent tell me that, you know, I want to say it was probably after about a month and a half of therapy, her child got his first star in school. And those are things that build children's confidence. You know, though all his friends are getting stars.
I was just thinking about the self-esteem
exactly,
aspect.
Exactly.
Of,
you know, he's never
gotten
a star.
Not feeling like you're different or...
Right. You know. He's never gotten a star in reading before, and then he got his first star after, you know, a month or two of therapy. And those are the kinds of things, that's when it really starts clicking at home and making a difference in the time it takes to get homework done, or the argument
yeah.
before getting homework done
yeah.
starts to go away. Those are the things that, to me, make it really worth my time.
Very good. Are there any other big conditions that you see, or groups of conditions?
Yeah, I think one huge one is probably ocular motor or tracking. And that's just the child's ability to follow along a page or make either smooth eye movements or fast eye movements, depending on what they need to do. So smooth would be, you know, reading across a line on a page, and then fast would be going to the next line. So you always have to make both types of movements, but that's very common, very, very common.
Okay, very good. One of the things that I was curious about as I was doing the research was the whole idea of myopia prevention? Like, okay. is that a myth? Is that
no?
Okay, it's not so much a myth.
There's also a lot of research in this that's all over the place, and there's a lot of different approaches that different doctors are taking to try to prevent myopia. I think the most important thing is define what you mean by prevent. Do you mean reverse? Because in that case, I would never promise that.
Right.
LASIK can reverse it, but therapy, I haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. You can stabilize it. You can make it not get worse. You can even, if it's not true myopia, for example, one of the bigger, more common conditions is convergence insufficiency. And what happens with those patients is if you give them lenses that correct for myopia, it actually improves their convergence. So they're again coping. They're asking for this lens. So they're not truly myopic, but they're asking for a lens that will help another condition. So once you've found that actual condition and fixed that condition, then yeah, they don't need their glasses mm-hmm. anymore, mm-hmm. but they never needed them in the first place.
Right.
So that's why I'm very careful about defining, are you really preventing it or was it ever there?
Right. So depends on what you find.
Exactly.
And what they expect. It's kind of an expectation.
Exactly.
Kind of what do you find and what
exactly.
are the expectations around
exactly.
that. You brought up the area of kind of research or new things. What is kind of coming that's exciting in your field down the pike?
What isn't exciting? I definitely think there's a lot more research being done. There's a new diagnostic tool or monitoring tool that's allowing a little bit more research in the area of using filters to improve reading skills, and that's something my office has just started doing as well.
What kind of filters?
So filters are tints. So
okay.
They're colored filters. We think of them as filters because they're filtering out wavelengths of light. And by doing that, you are either speeding up or slowing down the speed of the information getting back to your retina. So sometimes that needs to be equalized between the two eyes. So if the speed is getting to the retina through one eye quicker than the other, and this is very, simplified, but then you want to equal out that speed so that you end up getting kind of overwhelmed. And common symptoms of this would be the words are scrunching or moving or jumping or floating off of the page or the spaces in between the lines. So you'll have black lettering on a white page and those spaces kind of disappear while you're reading. So those kinds of symptoms sometimes filters help with. And again, you kind of always want to start at step one, is there anything else causing this? And then what is the efficiency of your system? And based on the efficiency of your system, is filters going to be your way to go or in terms of treatment, or is it going to be therapy?
So I'm kind of equating this, like if I could use an analogy to make mm-hmm. sure I understand,
sure.
like a graphic equalizer on sound waves, only you're looking on light waves.
So that might not be my area, but yes.
But you have bass and treble. I'm just thinking bass and treble to optimize my hearing,
yes.
how I hear.
Exactly.
I can optimize light waves
exactly.
to how my eyes
you
best see
it.
For me.
Okay, you
so
got
that would
it.
Be like the same thing. So what would be like the most common color that
oh,
you...
Oh, gosh.
Is there one?
No.
Okay.
No,
so
and that's really more dependent. So the filters, sometimes it's bluish or purplish, but it can go reddish or orange, and it really just depends.
Does your practice do any research?
Not now, no. No, we don't. I read a lot of research, of course, but no, I haven't done a whole lot. But this is actually a new area even for me because I had these handful of kids that I felt like therapy wasn't the way to go, and I wanted to find what is best for this group of children. Mm-hmm. So I actually did, some shadowing and reading and research to figure out that these filters are actually helping a lot of children all over the world, really. It's just not readily accepted here, and for good reason. We're one of those societies where we care what everybody looks like. So, you have to
kind of... I don't know. Colored shades are in. Are you kidding me?
So,
look at Kanye West for
you have to think about that. Are you going to send your child to school and he's going to become the kid with the orange glasses? So,
yeah.
Those are one of the
My
things that...
My kid would love that.
Yeah, So I think that might be part of the reason it's not as accepted here. But for the most part, when it helps, I think people run with it.
You should maybe do a case study. Publish a case study
I would
on
love
what you found. Yeah.
I would love to. And like I said, it's a new area for me. So I've actually got mentors that I speak with and listservs and, just a bunch of us nerds that kind of get together and share cases and experiences. And it's very, very helpful in learning what's out there, what we haven't really dug into.
Now, your specialty is not that common for people to be trained in. So, like, how many of there are? There aren't that many of you
no,
here.
No, there's not. Honestly, we have to do, I did a residency. So, in school, just optometry school alone, you don't spend a lot of time on this area. It has to be a passion for you, which I think is pretty common in any pediatric profession. So as long as it's a passion for you, there's lots of research or resources where you can take it a step further. So I did a residency, and then, of course, there's professional groups or classes, continuing education classes that you can do. But no, there's not a lot of us. There's a handful of us in Georgia and, you know, throughout the world, really.
Right. Very good. So believe it or not, we're almost at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. So before we sign off, let's kind of collect our thoughts. If there's some top takeaway, whether you're a referring school nurse or pediatrician, or you're just a concerned parent, mm-hmm. what are like your top three tips?
My top three tips, number one is get your child an eye exam from a specialist. The reason I say that a specialist is because there are questions I'm going to ask. There are things that I'm going to look for throughout the exam. Even if I just have the child read an eye chart, I'm looking for how he reads the eye chart. How is he sitting? Does he want to? There's certain things I look for as a specialist.
Nonverbal.
That are nonverbal cues that somebody else that's not a specialist might not look for. So get your child an eye exam if they haven't had one already would be my first take home. My second, in terms of talking to other health professionals, keep open-minded. You know, a lot of kids, even if they're making straight A's, that doesn't mean that they're doing it easily. I was a straight A student, but when I went to optometry school, part of the clue I got was that I'd be studying with one of my colleagues, and it's taking me note cards and writing everything out in order to learn something, and she can read it. Well, the reason is because it's a lot more difficult for me to read it. So even if it's an A student, I would still encourage people to get that eye exam from a specialist to see if you can make it easier for that child. And then lastly, I would say some of those things that might seem like avoidance or ADHD symptoms. And, you know, I would consider that it could be something visual as well. If you're having a problem with your child in particular, with reading and learning, I think it's important to remember that I've never met a child that didn't want to learn. Even watching my little 10-month-old, she'll pick something up. And of course, she eventually gets it to her mouth. But if you really watch a baby, they look at it first. They want to know what it is. And that continues throughout school-age children. They want to learn. So if you've got a child that is giving you problems at home in terms of learning, it's probably not because they don't want to learn it. That's rare.
Very good. Well, all good tips. Thank you so much for being
here. No problem.
Here. Before we sign off, let's make sure that we have people know how to find you.
Oh, sure. Our office is in Buckhead. It's Family Eye Care Center of Atlanta. And our phone number is 404-549-9999. And our website is familyeyecareatlanta.com.
Very good. So all of you check out Dr. Takiya Locke. Thank you so much
for coming today.
And hopefully we'll have you back on another topic. But
great.
Thank you so much.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks to all of you listeners for tuning in today. Please check out our sponsor's website, www.healthgate.com. Have a great sunny day. We'll see you next week.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.